From Heartache to Hope, from Selected Psalms. This is an exposition of Psalm 142. This message by Pastor Rod Harris was delivered at Trinity Baptist Church on Wednesday evening, February the 20th, 2019.
Well, in 2005, when Katrina hit, we all watched in horror to see the devastation along the Gulf Coast and then all that went on in New Orleans. Those images were breathtaking to me of the devastation, and to see the local authorities and the state authorities and others scrambling and pointing fingers of blame and who should have been better prepared and all of that. In the midst of all the finger pointing and all that going on, then you watched people and their whole lives being changed forever. And trying to imagine, what would that be like to lose everything and then be told, well, it's going to be weeks or months or years if you ever get back. Then to see them loaded on buses, herded onto buses and taken who knows where. As they got on the bus, they weren't sure where they were being taken. And then their families separated, and it was just a horrible time. And I remember watching some of that thinking, now, how come this is happening here? I mean, this isn't North Korea. Why is this happening here? Why aren't we better prepared than that? Why do we see this kind of thing happening here? But I also remember reading an article at the same time, just after that, and the article quoted a leading thinker. And yes, I'm putting thinker in scare quotes because I'm not sure how clear this thinker was. But he was a cultural analyst. And as he was thinking about the devastation on the Gulf Coast and all the issues surrounding that, he bemoaned the fact that in our advanced civilization, people still, in times of crisis, turn to primitive myths and superstitions, crying out to a non-existent God. Instead of understanding that this is just the result of living in a purposeless world. So this leading intellectual, this great thinker, says, I can't believe people are still praying to some non-existent God. Instead of just being encouraged and strengthened by the fact we live in a world without any purpose whatsoever. Deny it as much as you want. There is a God. He is there. Despite what others may think. Our text tonight is found in Psalm 142. So now it's a brief psalm. It's only 7 verses. It's a psalm of David. It's obvious again when we read through that David's in trouble again, which seems like to be a regular theme in David's life. David seemed to be regularly in trouble. But as you read through Psalm 142, you can hear the despair in his voice. It's a real troublesome time. He desperately cries out for mercy and hope because, as David writes, it becomes clear he is alone, he is abandoned, and he is frightened. We're told in the introduction that it is a maskil of David when he was in the cave. So, it is a psalm written, a maskil. What does that mean? We don't know. Some think that it may be a musical term of some sort. Others say, well, it refers to a contemplative poem. But we are given the context. It's when he was in the cave. So this is in the cave of Adullam. It's during that period of time in 1 Samuel chapter 22. David's on the run from King Saul. There he is in the cave. And he's crying out to God. Another psalm was written at the same time. That's Psalm 57. 142 was probably written before Psalm 57. Okay, so they're not in order. And the reason why we think Psalm 142 was written first is because the tone of it. He's desperate here. If you go and look at Psalm 57, it's much more hopeful So it probably was written after he comes to a different understanding by the end of this psalm. But after killing Goliath, David entered the military service of King Saul. Because David was blessed of God because of his natural ability, he inflamed Saul's jealousy. You remember the maidens would sing, Saul has slain his thousands, but David his tens of thousands, and that kind of thing. David was becoming extremely popular, and the king wasn't happy about that. And he got angrier and angrier as time went on. And so David finds himself having to flee from Saul's presence. He goes to the wilderness and he has no followers. He has no provisions. He has nowhere to turn. Ahimelech, the priest at Nob, gave him some food. He also gave him the sword which had belonged to Goliath. And eventually David finds himself in the cave of Adullam. Again, alone. No one's around him yet. And that's the context of Psalm 142. Written in that time before his brothers and others gathered about him. He is heartbroken. He is discouraged. And he cries out to God. With my voice I cry out to the Lord. With my voice I plead for the mercy of the Lord. I pour out my complaint before him. I tell my trouble before him. When my spirit faints within me, you know my way. In the path where I walk, they have hidden a trap for me. Look to the right and see. There is none who takes notice of me. No refuge remains for me. No one cares for my soul. I cry to you, O Lord. I say, you are my refuge, my portion in the land of the living. Attend to my cry, for I am brought very low. Deliver me from my persecutors, for they are too strong for me. Bring me out of prison, that I may give thanks to your name. The righteous will surround me, for ye will deal bountifully with me. As we work our way through these seven verses, we're reminded that God, in His grace and mercy, uses heartache, difficulty, and crisis to point out our inadequacy and His sufficiency. Part of the mercy and grace of God is to take the hard and difficult times in our life to reveal a couple of things to us. To reveal that we're inadequate. To remind us that we aren't capable of handling this. Sometimes we think, Lord, you're there if I need you and I'm going to handle this, but if I get in big trouble, you can take over. You know, the whole God is my co-pilot thing. If you live with that mentality, you really are in trouble. He's not your co-pilot. He better be your pilot. He better be the one driving. But we have this mentality, Lord, I'll let you know when I need you to take over, and then you take over and get me out of that. And the mentality is, and then once you get me out of it, I'll take control again, and then you can sit back until I need you. It's not David's mentality. God uses crisis to bring us to the end of ourselves. We are inadequate. We can't handle it. But the other thing a crisis does is to show us His sufficiency. We're inadequate. He is completely adequate. We can't deal with this. He is more than sufficient to deal with it. When we confess that God is sovereign, then we're saying that nothing occurs by chance or accident. We, as biblical believers, we don't believe in chance. We believe in a God who providentially works in all things. And if we believe that God is sovereign, if we believe in the doctrine of providence, if we believe that everything is the outworking of God's will, then that means every heartache, every trial, every difficult passes through Him to get to us. That's what it means to confess God is sovereign. We may not like it, we may not understand it, we may not understand how it fits in, but to say we believe in a sovereign God is to say we believe that whatever comes our way, God has allowed it and there is purpose in it. Contrary to the thinker, we don't live in a purposeless world. We live in a world that has purpose because there is a God behind it who moves all things according to His will and there is an end goal in mind. And so we rest in the assurance that our God is sovereign. He providentially works in all things for our good and for His glory. That's the point, again, the point of Romans 8:28. We know that all things work together for the good of those who love God and are called according to His purpose. That's not saying that everything that happens in our life is good. It doesn't mean that no unpleasant thing is ever going to come our way. It's merely a statement that we believe in a God who is powerful and merciful and gracious, and He will work all things together for our good and His glory. We don't relish the difficulty. We don't enjoy hardship. It's not that we look forward to pain. We're not masochists. But we believe that our God is powerful and He will work it to our good and His glory. And by the way, the good, if you continue reading Romans 8, is that we are conformed to the image and likeness of Jesus. That God uses hardship and struggle and trial to chip away those things that don't look like Jesus, to conform us to His image and likeness. Chipping away those things that hinder our growth spiritually and cause us to mature in our faith. As we walk through the psalm, we note a progress from heartache to hope. Four things I want to call to your attention. First, in verses 1 and 2, times of severe crisis ignite impassioned prayer. Times of severe crisis ignite impassioned prayer. Nothing helps your prayer life like good old-fashioned crisis. Nothing helps your praying like hard and difficult times. These verses set the tone. With my voice I cry out to the Lord. With my voice I plead for the mercy of the Lord. I pour out my complaint before Him. I tell my troubles before Him. David is pouring out his heart before God. He's pleading for God's intervention in the midst of his trouble. There is urgency in this. Just hear the words and hear the urgency in his voice. I cry out to the Lord. I plead for mercy. I pour out my complaints. I tell my trouble. So in other words, this isn't silent prayer. This isn't David sitting in the cave and quietly in the corner, bowing his head, and it's loud. It is a lament. It is a moaning. It is a crying out. It would have been echoing through that cave. David is in anguish. He is heartbroken. He doesn't understand why the Lord is allowing this. He is again, lamenting. Times of crisis produce urgency in our prayers. James Boyce, in his commentary of Psalm 142, makes a statement, "In easy times, our prayers are easy too. But they take on a new urgency when trouble comes." That's true. If things are great and everything is wonderful in my world, I pray with a casual sense. But when everything is going wrong, when all hell is breaking loose, I get very tense and very urgent in my praying. Something needs to happen. Something needs to change. The Lord needs to do something, and He needs to do it yesterday. There is an urgency. He is pleading for mercy. He seeks pity. He says he pours out his complaints. Now, that's not complaint in the sense of, I'm upset about this and I want to register an official complaint. The word that's translated complaint means, I pour out my trouble. I pour out my concern. So it's not that he is complaining that God isn't listening, that God doesn't care, or that God has done some evil, or that something wicked has happened, and the Lord is to blame for it. It simply means he's crying out to the Lord and laying his troubles out. These are my concerns. These are the things that burden me. These are the things that are bothering me. It's another thing about crisis. It makes our prayers very honest. And our whole attitude changes. Again, if you and I are go to lunch together and you say, well, why don't you pray and bless the food? Then you kind of bow your head and you kind of spit out this prayer that's in the back of your mind. You go through the little file thing real quick and pull out the one that's the lunchtime prayer and you just say it. But when there's some crisis comes, that changes everything. And there's this immediacy, there is this urgency, there is this vibrancy behind my praying. But don't miss the point. The point is, David went to the Lord with his concern. He's crying out to God. He's pouring out his heart before God. And again, it's not generic God. Because again, I call your attention to the word Lord in verse 1. And it's in all caps, so he's calling out to the covenant God. He's calling out to the God whom he has relationship with. He's calling out to the God who's made certain promises to his people. So it's not, he's not praying to God generic. He's not praying to this power, this influence. He is speaking specifically to God with whom he is in relationship. And he is expecting certain things because God has made promises. It seems crisis and hardship and struggle is good for our prayer life. One writer from the 19th century in his dealing with this psalm told the story about a little girl on the train taking a trip with her father, and the little girl was running around and bothering everybody on the train, and Dad kept calling her to come back and leave those people alone, and the little girl just completely ignoring him and doing whatever she wanted to do until the train went into a tunnel. And then when it went black, he heard her cry, and then she ran to her father's arms. I'm concerned with Dad's commands. I'm concerned with Dad's instruction until it got dark. And then she wanted the safety of her father's arms. That's the kind of thing we're talking about. Crisis, hardship, difficulty has a way of driving us to our father's arms. It's revealing our inadequacy, and it's reminding us of his sufficiency so that we're driven back to trust in him. Second, times of severe hardship magnify our impoverished condition. That's verses 3 and 4. It's not that hardship creates the impoverishment. It simply reveals it. It makes it obvious. It makes it clear. Magnifies it. It highlights. When my spirit faints within me, you know my way. In the path where I walk, they have hidden a trap for me. Look to the right and see. There's none who takes notice of me. No refuge remains for me. No one cares for my soul. His spirit faints. He is discouraged. He is troubled. His enemies have hidden traps along the path. And then there's that expression, there is no one to my right. What does that mean? Does it mean when David cries out, there's no one to my right? What does that mean? What is that reference to? The right is the place of trust. Your trusted one is on your right. Trusted soldiers, advisors, Alec, we still use the same language. We say, he's my right-hand man. By that we mean someone reliable, someone I can count on, someone I can trust, someone who is there with me and someone who is there for me. And David says, there's no one there. There's no one on my right. And he calls upon the Lord to look for himself. Lord, there's nobody on my right. You take a look and see. There's no one there. Lord, I'm alone. Lord, I have been abandoned. Now, David feels alone. And as far as David can tell, he is alone. Have you ever been there? You ever found yourself during a time of crisis that you felt like there's nobody there? Now, here's my question. David felt alone. He says, there is no refuge for me. There is no one who cares for my soul. Now here's the question. Was David right? That's how he felt. It's how it seemed. But is it the truth? Seems to me David has forgotten some things that he has earlier confessed. Psalm 16 and verse 8. I have set the Lord always before me because He is my right hand. I shall not be shaken. So in another place, at another time, David said, the Lord is my right hand. And the Lord is always there, and therefore I can never be shaken. Well, apparently he's forgotten that. Apparently his sight has been clouded, obscured. Ever happened to you? Ever have a time when your sight isn't too clear? That your circumstance, the heartache, the difficulty has blinded you to reality? That's where David is. Or how about Psalm 23? He makes me to lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside quiet waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in the paths of righteousness. For His namesake, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil. Why? Because You are with me. Your rod and Your staff, they comfort me. Apparently he's forgotten that. Because crisis has a way of doing that. Hardship and difficulty and heartache has a way of causing us to be forgetful. It's hard in the midst of the struggle to remember. David is surrounded by enemies. As a result, he lost sight of the fact that he was not alone. The same God who delivered Goliath into his hand was still present. God didn't need to look at David's right hand. God already knew, but David needed some help. David needed some clarity. He needed some understanding. A third thing, verses 5 through 7. Times of desperation thrust us into new and greater heights. I cry to You, O Lord. I say, You're my refuge, my portion in the land of the living. Attend to my cry, for I'm brought very low. Deliver me from my persecutors, for they are too strong for me. Again, in the crisis, the Lord uses the crisis. He uses the hardship. He uses the difficulty. He uses the struggle to remind us we're inadequate. We don't have sufficient resources. But He is sufficient. So David's starting to turn the corner as he's pouring out his heart, as he's listing his complaints, as he's crying out and pleading for mercy. He's changing. Prayer does change things. And it begins by changing us. Again, as we see so often in the Psalms, as the psalmist cries out, change occurs. Not in a circumstance, but in him. He begins to see things differently as he verbalizes, as he talks about it, his vision begins to clear and he begins to see things differently. He begins to see the Lord is there. And that's what he goes on to confess in this section. David looked to his right hand. He said, there's no one there. Nobody cares for my soul. What is he saying now? I turn to You and You are my refuge. He just said there is no refuge. Now he says the Lord is my refuge. He is my place of safety. He is my place of rest. He is my peace. He is my assurance. I referred to Psalm 57 earlier. We're listening to Psalm 57 and verse 1. Be merciful to me, O God. Be merciful to me. For in You my soul takes refuge. In the shadow of Your wings I take refuge till the storms of destruction pass by. That's why I think it's true to say that Psalm 57 was probably written after this one. After David came to the point to say, You are my refuge, then he's able to write what he does in Psalm 57 and verse 1. He is our refuge. He is our place of safety from our enemies. He is our portion. God is not only our shield in battle, but He is our reward, far greater than the spoils of war. He is our Savior. He is our deliverer. He is our liberator. But it's only when we come to the end of ourselves that we can see clearly the greatness of our God and His provision for us. as long as you hold on to the possibility that you can get out of this, as long as you hold on to the possibility that maybe you can pull yourself up and get out of this difficulty and somehow work through it, you won't see. But when you get to the point to say, I can't do that, you see that there is only one hope. And it clears up. Your vision clears and you begin to see God for who He is. And you begin to understand this is why He is worthy of all your trust. And it kindles new hope. That's the fourth thing I want you to see. It's there in verse 7. Bring me out of my prison that I may give thanks to your name. The righteous will surround me, for ye will deal bountifully with me. He goes from, I'm crying out because I'm in a horrible spot and there is no one at my right hand. There is no refuge for me. This is horrible. This is awful. To now he ends by saying, you will deal bountifully with me. You will supply for me. And I'm going to be surrounded by the righteous. I'm going to be provided for. He went from heartache to hope. He went from despair to praise. Times of severe trial ignite impassioned prayer. Times of severe hardship magnify our impoverished condition. Times of despair thrust us into new and greater heights. And such insight rekindles our hope. God, in grace and mercy, uses our heartache, our difficulty, our crisis to point out our inadequacy so that we might see clearly His sufficiency. It's what it means to profess and to believe and to trust in a God who is sovereign. It's not that I'll be without heartache. It's not that there will be no trials. But it means no matter what comes, my God is fully in control and He has purpose behind everything that comes into my life. That's what it means to rest in the sovereignty of our God.
You've been listening to the TBC Tulsa podcast, which features the preaching ministry of Pastor Rod Harris at Trinity Baptist Church in Tulsa, Oklahoma, located at the corner of 41st and Union. To learn more about the ministries at Trinity Baptist Church, visit us on the web at www.tbctulsa.org.
take your prayer sheet and see if there are any folks that you can give us an update on, or if there's someone you need to add to the prayer list. Richard. Right.
And so they're looking pretty good. We don't know what will happen in the future.
If you're not familiar with St. Simeon's, it's a really quality place. My dad was there for quite a while and got really, really good care there. So grateful for that. But pray for George and Betty and how long they'll be able to stay, and what the next step is going to be, because that's still up in the air for now. Other updates or prayer requests? She is St. John Rehab Hospital in Broken Arrow. I saw her on Monday. She looks a whole lot better. She did get started on dialysis, and that's really making a world of difference. But as you know, when you start that, you're on it. So it's going to be 3 days a week from now on. She's there now because they can do it right there. If they get her strong enough and she's able to come home, then they'll have to take her 3 days a week. And it takes about 3 to 4 hours to go to get the dialysis done. So at this point, she's not strong enough that they could take her some way and she's sitting in a chair or whatever for that long a period of time. But world of difference between the last time I'd seen her and when I saw her Monday. Color was much better. She was able to talk without having to stop for breathing, and she just looked a whole lot better, sounded better, was in much better spirits. So, but that's right there at the same, if you know where St. John's is in Broken Arrow, it's the same complex. It's just around on the west side, back behind the assisted living that Joanne True has been living in. It's on the back side of that. But St. John Rehab Hospital is the name of it. Any others? No, she's in a regular room. She is in room 1250 at St. John, Tulsa. Yeah. About the only surgeries they do at St. John Broken Arrow at this point is like joint replacement and those type of surgeries. So she came to Tulsa for that surgery.
Who are you talking about?
Joanne True. The other was Zalinda Pierman. Okay. They went to Fayetteville today for follow-up with the surgeon, and I haven't heard report from that. But as far as I know, she hasn't started the chemo and radiation yet. But she was going to be on that for several weeks and then have a week off and then start back again. So I'm not sure how many weeks total, but it's several. And we do have the prayer sheet tonight. If you haven't signed up for that, there's still opportunity to do so for Saturday. Most spots are filled, but there are still 4 spots open. If you haven't signed up and you want to, there's opportunity to do that tonight. Even if you don't sign up, if you just find you have some time Saturday, just come whenever you want. Between 9:30 and 3:30 in the afternoon.
When's the deal at
Then the 14th of March is the fundraiser.
14th of March.
Yeah. Also, because some have asked about just direct donation, you can always do that anytime through the church. I mean, that's fine if you want to give a love offering you're able to do that. There is also a GoFundMe account that's been set up in their name, so you could go online and do it that way, and that would go directly into that account. Or you can give through the church, but because some have asked about that, so that's always available in these kind of circumstances. But the fundraiser that's been organized, and again, we didn't initiate that. That was asked by someone else, and they needed to work with someone, and so they asked if the church would be involved. That's how we got involved in that. So some are asking, well, why is the church doing that instead of just taking an offering? That's why. We didn't initiate it. We're just helping the ones who did initiate it. There are always, when there's a need in the church that you're aware of, you are always free to give money to the church in their name and take care of that. That happens regularly when people just want to give a gift anonymously or whatever. So that option is always available to you. Anything else before we pray? All right. Well, let me encourage you just to pray together around the table about these concerns. If there's something else you want to share with the group that you're with, do that. And when you're finished praying, you're dismissed. The sign-up sheet will be here on this table if you need to do that. Thank you. Also, one other thing, don't forget, Sunday we will celebrate the Lord's table in the Sunday morning service. So, deacons, a letter went out yesterday to you. And just be aware of that. But that will be part of our service Sunday morning. Just wanted to make you aware of that.